Welcome to Ear to the Pavement. I'm Allison Lierish-Dean. Today's show features part two of my conversation with writer and activist Yasmin Nair about white feminism. We're looking at two recent books on the topic, Kyla Schuller's The Trouble with White Women and Rafia Zakaria's Against White Feminism. If you haven't already heard part one, do check it out, as this episode does relate back to some of the stuff we talked about there. These episodes are part of a series of three in which Yasmin and I delve into recent books about feminism. In our next conversation, we'll cover Amiya Srinivasan's The Right to Sex. That's coming this fall. I also wanted to issue a correction to part one in this series. In the intro of that episode, I recommend an article by Cedric Johnson that goes into the history of whiteness studies, which I think provides some useful background and context to these books about white feminism. I incorrectly referred to Johnson's article as The Wages of Whiteness, but in fact its title is The Wages of Roediger. Apologies for that, and please do check it out on nonsite.org. After both the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, the media was flooded with discourse about the white female Trump voter. A sampling of these headlines across diverse publications reads, "White women need to admit we let this happen. White women sold out the sisterhood and the world by voting for Trump," and "White women have to answer for backing the Republican nominee yet again." I mention all of this because Kyla Schuller and Rafia Zakaria both tackle the question of the white female Trump voter, and Schuller even opens her book with it, establishing it as an important touchstone for contemporary feminist analysis. I started this part of my conversation with Yasmin by delving into this issue of the white woman Trump voter and how it's functioning in Schuller's and Zakaria's books. One of the things I thought was really interesting in the Zakaria book was that there's a bit when she talks about the white Trump voters. It's in the chapter called From Deconstruction to Reconstruction, page 195.
Yeah, okay.
So the thing that I wanted to unpack a little bit is she talks about the Women's March post-Trump being elected. And she talks about a writer named Arielle Marie Lucier. This is on page 194, actually. She, writing in Essence magazine, talked about the passive racism she experienced at the march, from being pushed into a trash can by a nasty woman to being racially profiled by an elderly white feminist, and concluded that white women had marched for themselves alone. So she talks about how one of the things that Lucier said in response to this was that, quote, "I'm sorry, white women, some of you helped us get into this mess. Perhaps it's not your voices that need to be amplified in the aftermath." And then on the next page, Zakaria herself does some analysis of this. And she says, "Many of the white women who marched in 2017 wanted to show their political opposition to the election of President Donald Trump. Yet while they did so, those who claimed color blindness failed to acknowledge that for Black and brown women, the election of Trump presented an actual threat. Even worse, they did not use the activism of that moment to acknowledge the role white women's support for white supremacy had played in the election. In 2020, when Trump lost, it was again revealed that white women increased their support for Trump, with 55% of them voting for the president's reelection. The number is particularly revealing because following the 2016 election, few white women, such as those quoted above, saw racism as a problem among themselves. It is also notable that more than 80% of Black women, the highest percentage by demographic, voted against President Donald Trump." So I get what she's saying, but I think that that narrative sort of glosses over some of the complexity of what was going on, especially when you look at 2016 compared to 2020. I mean, it is true that Trump increased his vote share among all demographic groups. And I think the biggest jump was with Latino voters.
Yes, yeah.
And so I kind of, and she doesn't really mention that. I mean, I think I also just, you know, white women are kind of treated as this sort of coherent group, which I think is interesting, as if race is kind of the only thing that really holds people together. And I don't know. I was wondering how those women might have used the activism of that moment. I mean, I wasn't at that march, and, you know, there's a lot I probably don't know, but, you know, how might they have used, what would it have looked like for them to use the activism of that moment to acknowledge the role white women's support for white supremacy had played in the election?
So you're asking, what could white women have done differently?
I mean, I mm-hmm. think there's a lot that white women could have done differently. I'm not disputing that mm-hmm. the way they organized the march was, I mean, I don't know a lot of the inside details, but I'm not right. disputing her perception that it was not, you know, sure. well done.
And no, that
there was even racism, you know, involved in some of the sure. things. I guess what I'm getting at is like the idea of being a white woman who doesn't like Trump and didn't vote for Trump and has politics that are opposed to what Trump is doing, but then kind of looking at things through this racial lens and saying, I'm going to call out these other white women because I'm a member of their group. You know what I mean? I think I'm wanting to talk about this idea that as white women, they should have been thinking about themselves as a member of this larger group of white women.
I see what you mean.
You know what I mean? Yes, that yes, should yes. have been calling out right. Trump, calling out their quote unquote group. Like, well, I'm not sure that they would see, I'm not sure that white women mm-hmm. who have one set of politics see themselves first and foremost as part white. Of a white group. So I'm trying to figure out like, what would that have looked like or what exactly is she asking for is what I'm trying to suss out a little bit more.
So I think what you're getting at is something that emerges perhaps in both the books, which is to say the question of, do white women identify as white?
Right.
Does a white feminist actually identify as a white feminist, or does she identify as a feminist? Does she even identify as a feminist? Mm-hmm. What do these categories mean for women in the moment?
Right.
And what do they mean for someone outside or inside outside analyzing all of this? And I think that's one issue.
Like one of the reasons I bring that up is because like I come from a family where there's actually a lot of wide spectrum of politics. So I know there are white women in my family who didn't vote at all. Who are like, fuck it, you know, there's no point. Then there's white women who I'm pretty sure there's definitely white women who are Trump supporters in my family. And I have a lot of, it's difficult to talk to them. Like I don't, you know, and I don't identify with them. Like I would say that my first and foremost identity is not like with them is not like we're all white. It's actually more complicated than that. And so I think I think I'm trying to understand like how that sure. works. You know what I mean? Like
I think what Zakaria does not get at, because I don't think there's a language for this right now. Mm-hmm. I think what Zakaria does not get at is how whiteness is an identity that people step into regardless of whether or not they understand that they're stepping into it.
Right.
And I think this is where the narrative of looking inward and also the narrative of agency fails us.
Mm.
In the same way that and any analysis of capitalism as something that you do or do not do, which is to say, do you switch out your light bulbs or not? That's how you move against capitalism. Do you eat the right kind of tuna that's not been snapped up? But, you know. So I think this is the failure of an analysis of whiteness and as along with an analysis of capitalism, which is to say, we fail to understand how these identities co-opt us without even our knowledge or even perhaps without our consent.
Right, right.
So when you're talking to when you're not talking to your relatives, mm-hmm. the women in your family,
mm-hmm.
you are not necessarily combating them as a white woman, and they are not necessarily, there are deeply racist people who will say, you know, I will vote for Trump or someone like him because mm-hmm. it's all about the white race. Yes. I mean, mm-hmm, let's mm-hmm. put aside that extremist position for a second at least,
mm-hmm.
Because we do have shooters who move into malls and kill people because their fear about the white race. That's fine. But I think in a more general way, the people aren't living their lives, or they are and they aren't. I think the question for any scholars of whiteness is to understand how whiteness operates as an apparatus, right? Mm-hmm. So for mm-hmm. instance, okay, so the best example I have is of the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there's all of this talk about needing to build quote unquote black wealth, which, you know, let's put aside the problematics of thinking about wealth and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that, yes, it is the case that black homeowners are much more likely to face resistance from banks to not even get loans in the first place. And that's one reason why there isn't, we see this in Chicago and many other places, there are, you know, people, black people's homes have literally been taken away from them.
Right.
If they were even given loans in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. Now that is an effect of whiteness, you know, even something as simple as restaurant deliveries, redlining, all of that, right?
Yep.
So all of that is a way in which whiteness does operate on a systemic level to push out or to not even let blackness enter. Whereas in contrast, for instance, and again, I don't want to make too facile an assumption, but in contrast, you know, an Asian immigrant, for instance, with a certain amount of money, et cetera, may have more access to loans for housing, for businesses and so on. So there is a way in which whiteness operates in those structural ways, but do people go looking for loans saying, I'm a white person, I will get this loan? Perhaps not, but they are still the beneficiaries of a structure, of a structure that is systemically bound to whitening of neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And
so the fact that, you know, Barack Obama, a black ex-president, is doing gentrification, right, is massively gentrifying the south side of Chicago, then completely passes everyone's notice because he's a black man. So, you know, I think the issue, I think the complicated questions for us are, how do we, why are we constantly tied to our identity formations in discussing how identity plays a role within capitalism? And the problem for Kyla Schuller, the problem I have rather with Kyla Schuller, is that she is connected to her identity as a white person, or at least white seeming. I don't know. Maybe she's, maybe she'll come out with a story, but I haven't read her personal narrative. Maybe she's multiracial.
Well, and I mean, in the introduction, the person who writes the introduction, whose name?
Brittany Cooper.
Brittany Cooper. She says, I don't count many white women among my friends, but you know, so I mean, I think she's fairly described
she's white,
as,
white,
as white.
White. Right.
Yeah, I think
so
that's.
I think the problem is Kyla Schuller does not know how to think about whiteness and blackness without, in many ways, actually cleaving to her own identity as a white person.
Yeah.
The whole book is about I am white and I'm telling you why all of this is racist. And I find that deeply unproductive. Rafia Zakaria positions herself against a certain form of whiteness. And again, we go back to the bar. Who are these white women and why are you with them? Is a necessary question. It's not a facile question. It's like,
no, I actually wrote that in the margins. I wrote, who are these women? Like,
who are these women in the 21st century in New York City? Again, I know that racism exists in within all kinds of communities, but if you're with these women, there's a problem there. You need new friends.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
And again, this may have been, to be fair, this may have been a professional setting, etc. You know, to be fair, yes, but. But and I'm also sympathetic to the fact that you're writing a book, and so in writing a book, you come up with certain narratives and stories, and there isn't a lot of place to. It's not you don't just draw out all the complexities of the situation, etc.
Yeah.
But the problem is not the anecdote itself. The problem is how the structuring of that anecdote, as these are very specific kinds of white women, and I was a very specific kind of brown woman. That strand plays out throughout the book. And it diminishes the possibility of thinking about whiteness as something that is both more pervasive and also not as uncomplicated as we might want to imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just come back to this question of like what would it have looked like for the women at that march to, again, like...
But here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. But here's the problem. There is no way to think about that question. I would say there is no way to think about that question because, and this is where I think the NGOization and the sort of non-profitization and the distillation of political movements into racialized categories, which don't look like racialized categories. This is where all the problem lies. So the problem is that the women's... So for me, I actually don't want to think about what would have looked like for these women. And maybe that's her question, and I don't think that's a good question. I think the larger question has to be, what does the structure behind these kinds of protest movements actually look like?
Right,
and the issue is not, can we diversify them? Because that's a crock. Mm-hmm. The issue is that, yes, actually we do need more diverse bodies, but we actually need a whole different mindset of thinking. And I think this is the issue also for me with abortion right now. People keep asking me, well, what can we do? And the frustrating answer for them, for me, is it's not a question of what you can do. It's a question of how do you rethink this whole history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? So don't tell me about what to do, because then you're going to decide that you're going to dress up as a bloody Handmaid's Tale figure. Right. That's your sense of doing. Don't tell me what to do, because then you're going to give money to Planned Parenthood,
mm-hmm.
which is a heinous operation that needs to be shut down. No one's going to listen to me about that. But I think Planned Parenthood needs to disappear. The fact that we are so terrified of Planned Parenthood disappearing is a symptom of how bad the doing has become.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't think it's really in any ways, to me, it's not a useful question to ask, what could these women do?
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's more useful to ask, what can we do to shift the structures of power that create these marches such that these are the things that happen?
Right.
Because right now we're still thinking along, you know, the question of identity. Yes, Black women felt, and all of this was absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
It did become a white women's pussy march.
Mm-hmm.
It
did
become, you know, Black women being basically told I didn't see this. I don't recall the op-ed, but apparently there was a whole op-ed basically telling Black women to shut up.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. If we were to think historically, rather than through personal narrative, and that's what Kyla Schuler does, which is to say she thinks through personal narrative.
Mm-hmm,
she doesn't. Mm-hmm, what is interesting to me is how Schuler presents historical narratives without a historical framework.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Represents history as a personal narrative,
mm-hmm,
which is a terrible thing to do, because then you're never going to change history. Mm-hmm. You're never going to change the course of history. All you're going to say is, give us more personal narratives. And I think if we were to think about how do we do this march differently, well, first of all, to be honest, I mean, the marching against Trump itself is a problem in the sense that it really amplified the idea that Trump was the problem. So
yes,
for me, that
absolutely.
March was always a problem. That march was always, and I've written a couple of pieces about that, where I've said, don't march as anti-Trumpers. You know, march as feminists.
Mm-hmm.
But, or rather, march not as women, but as feminists. And then you have to redefine what a feminist is. And a feminist is not someone who brings a woman's consciousness, quote unquote, into the matter. A feminist is someone who actually does think about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no point in doing things if you're not actually embedded in different ways of thinking about what you're doing.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's I appreciate what you're saying. I think it's absolutely right on, and I totally agree with it. And I feel like that moment in the book, you know, was kind of an example of where I felt like it was a call to self-examine more so than a call to look outward at the structures that produce these kinds of responses, right, to the problems at hand. Like, it wasn't a calling into question the response or the structural thinking about what to do in the moment. It was more like, how can we make this march less controlled by white women who are, you know, whose group is kind of part of the problem anyway, because half of them voted for Trump. And so that kind of made me question, like, well, like, how can we think about this a little bit differently?
And I think also we're not asking, well, why did these white women vote for Trump?
Right, right. No,
why did Latinos vote for Trump?
I think it's a great question. Yeah, exactly.
Those are not the questions that we really want to answer, because again, and you know, because like a lot of white people, like Kyla Schuler, we're uncomfortable with that narrative, with asking those questions.
Right.
We're uncomfortable with acknowledging that, for instance, you know, Florida is mostly Miami is almost all Latina.
Right.
It votes heavily for Trump. And that has a lot to do with its politics about Cuba.
Right. And I think that does actually relate back to what we were saying earlier about this kind of Kyla Schuler's whole thing about Black woman good, white woman bad. Because it's like we can think about, I actually do think white people think a lot more about why other white people voted for Trump, because so many of them have families with white people in them, and there's,
right.
you know,
yes.
they yeah. think more about that than they do about why is it that Trump is increasing his support among Black people and Latino people and,
yes, you know, you're right.
all groups. Right. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think there's a lot of analysis about that. I think it's a very simplistic dichotomy that gets set up. And it reinforces this idea that white people are the problem and Trump is the problem. I mean, white people are the problem. It's yes and both. But yes, it's also both. But it's also that, like, you know, Trump is also not the problem. But it re- I mean, no, he
Trump
is.
Trump has never been the problem.
He
Trump
is
has never
he is,
been the problem.
Right.
He
exactly.
is and he isn't.
Right.
He's a symptom.
But
right.
I think it reinforces this idea that Trump is the problem, you know, exactly right. like what you're saying. And I think if we don't get away from that, that's you're engaging in an increasingly, I think, dangerous politics that is not
Absolutely.
Going to move beyond. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, everything you said is
the return
exactly
to
on
Trump.
The money.
The return, the constant, thank you. The constant return to Trump is the one of the biggest failures of the broad left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is to say, I've been watching, for instance,
the hearings.
I haven't been watching them, to be honest. I haven't
yeah.
been watching them. I've watched them, you know, talked about on, I only watch Democracy Now. Not, this is not to endorse Democracy Now, which I
right.
find a deeply flawed program, but it is the only sort of lefty TV thing that
right.
I can think about.
Right.
But, you know, but this obsession on the left and everywhere else among liberals, oh, liberals, of course, are dreadful with it, but this obsession with Trump and January 6th.
Mm.
And those were horrific, absolutely horrific happenings, absolutely terrible events. But it allows us, you know, this whole ketchup business, for instance, as you and I speak,
mm-hmm.
we just saw an explosion of ketchup memes because apparently Trump threw his meal against the wall when he was told he couldn't
right.
do something
right.
and the ketchup flowed down, just to give people a context of what we're talking about. But these kinds, you know, the emphasis now and the memeifying of that moment, as if somehow that is what matters, is we find out even more again and again and again, we find out that Trump is basically a big baby. Fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How is this new knowledge? The other thing I will also say, you know, as a side note, is that Trump is not half as stupid as we want to think he is, but that's
mm-hmm.
a whole other conversation
mm-hmm.
we can have. And I've written about this elsewhere. But this is, you know, the constant use of various figures and events like Trump, January 6th, to constantly reaffirm blackness versus whiteness or race in very particular ways. What you said to me about white people are not actually thinking about why did more Black or Latinos vote for Trump, but rather thinking why are more white people voting for Trump as it plays out in their families. I think that's
mm-hmm.
really important, because there is, I think, a great deal of complexity for a lot of white voters whose families are not as homogenous
mm-hmm.
as I think either Zakaria or Shula might imagine. And I think
mm-hmm.
that's the other problem I have, is this kind of homogeneity ascribed to all racial categories. Now,
mm-hmm.
of course, in Shula's case, there are apparently only two.
But, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in Zakaria's case, there's brown and then there's white. I don't know. You know, but there's a homogenization, which also, I think, comes from, to go back to the publishing industry aspect of all of this, which is to say it comes from a certain kind of left framework, which does not actually consider how life really works in
mm-hmm.
the rest of the country outside, say, the Kingdom of Brooklyn or the Haven of DC.
That is true. Yeah.
Or Chicago. For that
I mean,
matter.
I saw this tweet the other day. Somebody was saying, I wish I had screenshotted it. Somebody was saying something like, hey, I think it was a white person that was actually saying this. I'm pretty sure it was a white person, but they were like, and you know, of course, with all the caveats about how more than half of Twitter is bots and whatever. I mean,
yes.
You know, but I thought it encapsulated something interesting, which is the person was saying, you know, about another person of color, this person of color isn't responsible for Trump. And hey, I don't have these white people in my family who are voting for Trump. Hey, all you white people who have people in your family that are voting for Trump, it's on you to like go talk to these people, you know? And I thought that's so interesting. It's like saying, hey, I live in Brooklyn and I've never been exposed. Like I've heard people
right.
say so many times, like, I don't know these people. I've never met them. And And it's like,
well, I have.
Right. There's a certain like, there's a certain like kind of, I don't have responsibility because they're not in my family, you know? And I'm just kind of like,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It's really.
And a lot of these are also, I will point out, a lot of these people living in Brooklyn and making these statements are also transplants from elsewhere.
Exactly.
From places like Ann Arbor and Indiana, who are now trying to imagine themselves as having always been in Brooklyn or Queens or Chicago. You know, at least that's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. But I think, again, this is because of how publishing the publishing world feels the need to frame the United States in very specific ways, and where it actually doesn't understand how a whole why it was taken by surprise, I think.
Right.
Even Trump, we have to remember, Trump the night before was really surprised. He actually turned around and he said to someone at a rally, he said, "This doesn't feel like second place. What's going on?"
Right. I know. I remember Trump, that. Yeah.
Yeah. Trump was taken by surprise. So I think what we forget is that, you know, in large parts of the country, economic devastation, the rise in inequality, all of that began to hurt people in the majority part of the country before they hurt people in Chicago and New York City and so on.
Yeah.
Those people were hurting a lot. You know, I lived in Indiana from, 1899.
Yeah.
Yes, I am truly old. From 1989 to about 2000. Mm-hmm. So it's about 10, 11 years, right? Mm-hmm. If my math is correct. And, you know, there were moments where I would, you know, encounter someone. I remember going to a car washing place, and the woman literally threw my Visa card at me.
Wow.
She was furious. And there was, you know, another guy who was actually Latina behind me in a bank who muttered about these students getting all these loans and cards and so on.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it was very frightening, yes. But also I was living in a place where the biggest employer were, two biggest employers were Subaru and Purdue, the university.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of the, you know, in some ways, the industrial rust belt, right?
Yeah.
So this has been, I could retreat into a narrative about racism, and it was very racist.
Yes,
of course it was.
Of course,
it manifested as racism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that unhappiness has been swirling around in many parts of the country for a very long time. People have been deeply depressed economically, and I would argue that, you know, mentally for a very long time in many parts of the country.
Yeah.
And this, the United States is a master at self-denial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it just caught up. And then suddenly everyone's going, wait, well, how is Trump possible? And now, of course, the impulse is to see the years from 2016 to 2020 as some weird blip. And in this country's history, we have lost democracy. No,
right.
We never had democracy. Who had democracy in this country?
Right.
And
right.
What is democracy
anyway?
That's another question.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's like all a certain class.
It's like abortion.
Yeah, yeah, a certain class of people is suddenly quote unquote losing democracy, but that's not. You know, that's,
it's like abortion. It's like abortion. Right now, you have people like Gia Tolentino writing in the New Yorker and people writing in the New York Times about how horrific it is that abortion rights have been lost everywhere. And oh, look, let's have a video of this woman recounting her sad story of not being able to get an abortion. This has been the reality for decades now. If you are a poor woman outside, not even outside, in even a relatively well-off suburb, your access to abortion was denied a long time ago.
Yeah.
If not in actual fact, certainly by sheer dint of the fact that you, for instance, would have had to take days off from work. There are waiting periods. There are questions, etc. You know, it's been impossible for a lot of women who have then been forced into motherhood against their will.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I wish that these writers would, you know, we're kind of moving into a slightly different topic, but I wish a lot of these writers would talk about the Supreme Court decision in a different way, like rather than being like, this is the end of abortion, and you know,
they can't again,
like,
this is
like
where,
to talk about it as something to do with the larger process of what's happening to the institutions and the power structures, and like,
but,
you know what I mean? Like, because it's not as though I mean, but I understand the desire to acknowledge it as a shift, but I don't get.
It's not a shift. And that I think it is not a shift.
Say more about that.
It is not a shift. You know, someone asked me, David Parsons and I were talking about this on the Nostalgia Trap podcast,
right.
And he said, you know, what do you say about the reversal? And I said, it's not a reversal. This has been the reality for women for decades. So how can we ever say it's a shift?
So you don't see there being Roe
was always bad.
Right.
And that's one of the few things Ginsburg was terribly problematic in 100 different ways.
Right.
But, you know, she pointed out Roe was always a bad decision.
Mm.
And Roe was always in some ways a weird decision in that it was made very quickly. It was a band-aid operation in essence. It meant, you know, we don't have time to go into whole complicated history of all of that. It was also based on the need of a woman who was essentially not allowed to have an abortion, even though anyway, there are longer stories behind Roe.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Roe was a terrible decision to start with because it was based primarily on the idea of privacy, mm-hmm. which is also why Lawrence v. Texas is a terrible decision because it's also based on the idea of privacy. You know, sodomy is not outlawed in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence v. Texas meant is that you could commit, quote unquote, or perform sodomy in the environments in the privacy of your bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But queer sex workers working on the street can still be picked up for sodomy, mm-hmm. and they are. And they're mm-hmm. then placed on sex offender registries.
Mm.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is that in America, there's always been two-thirds of the country or more that has actually been suffering the effects of, for instance, a lack of access to abortion,
mm-hmm.
or for that matter, a lack of access to privacy rights when it comes to sexual acts. And then there have been the privileged few
mm-hmm.
who get away with, for instance, either living in a city where they have access perhaps to abortion services or have private health care. Women with private health care are not going to have a problem even now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So,
so
we have to remember that. And so I find it kind of infuriating when people say, oh, now this is a huge shift and this is the end of... Like, no, it has always been the... Look, even as someone who's... I have not many privileges, but if I had to get an abortion to... let's say the day before the Roe v. Wade decision came down,
mm-hmm.
if I had to get an abortion, I would still have to fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford the $250, $300, whatever dollars it takes. And it turns out that there's only actually one place in Chicago, a major city, there's only really one place I could probably access. And that would require either a friend driving me or an expensive Lyft or several bus trips.
Yeah, yeah. What I guess I'm wondering, and maybe this is a dumb question, but like, is there any sense in which it's institutionally significant? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, as a separate issue from the practical,
right?
That's what
the law. Sure.
Yeah,
sure,
just in terms of like what kind of what it signals about what else the Supreme Court is going to do.
I mean, yes and no, because I know, for instance, people are bringing. I mean, yes and no. I'm looking at it perhaps from the ultra left position, which is bring all of this down. Let's end this. End gay marriage.
Yep.
End the system that requires 9 carcasses to make decisions about whether or not you can have contraceptives or abortions. Right. That is, and instead, what we have is people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar demanding now that the Supreme Court be increased in number. And I thought, really? Mm-hmm. You want more lifetime tenured carcasses, basically, you know, deciding? And, okay, you get one young white woman in her, maybe is Amy Coney Barrett even 40, I'm not sure. And you get the most conservative, someone who's even more conservative than most of the white men on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so this is what you get with diversity. So, or expanding. What do you mean? I mean, it's so ill thought.
Yeah,
the whole what we're not giving thought to is how do we upend the system?
Mm.
How do we work to demolish the power of the Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we so worshipful towards the Supreme Court in this mm-hmm. country? You know, if times have changed to the extent, you know, Ilhan Omar's argument is that, well, you know, the Supreme Court has shifted in number because with the number of Americans, blah. Well, how about the world has changed? So perhaps our lives should not be held in the hands of 9 people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely.
How ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
It's not even a system, a legal system where you have, you know, different disparate judicial entities making decisions that can be it's the Supreme Court has spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the founding fathers.
Right.
I mean, rubbish that we then end up debating,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is not even, to me, we're even, people will say, you know, oh, it's so hard though to get rid of the Supreme Court. Well, no, actually it's not. If you just start to rethink your strategies and I don't know. We're now in a position where all we're doing is asking people to fund organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm tired, man. I'm just tired.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate you unpacking all that. I know this is slightly maybe
I know
a bit...
that legally it matters, right?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. But
oh,
no,
that's okay.
Look, I know that if you are 20-something, 30-something, whatever age, if you're a person with a uterus and you may be pregnant,
mm-hmm.
right? If you may become pregnant, if your your contraception fails, whatever happens, then you have reason to be terrified of the new reality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that there isn't a new reality. What mm-hmm. I am saying is this has A, been the reality for many millions for a very long time, and B, the fact that the law has changed. The issue then is to think about how to end that system rather than to only live in the moment of that change.
Mm-hmm,
and this,
mm-hmm.
I think, is where, and I say this as someone who's not a trained historian at all, I do think history matters a great deal. And I think this is my irritation with Kyla Schuller,
yeah.
to bring me back to the
right,
conversation
right.
about the two books.
Right.
My irritation with Kyla Schuller is how she rewrites history itself. Now, keeping in mind, of course, that there is no such thing as a true history narrative, because
right.
history itself is always written.
Mm-hmm.
But there are ways in which we might cast history differently. So instead
mm-hmm.
of casting history as essential narratives about, you know, enslaved people and their narratives are about Native American children and their dreams of red apples, we might think more critically of
mm-hmm.
what those narratives sustain. And I think the same thing is true for Rafia Zakaria, which is just, and interestingly, you know, I mean, again, it's Zakaria is more perhaps of a manifesto
mm-hmm.
rather than a historical take, but you know, this sense of things needing to spring from personal experience is also a problem for me.
Mm.
I found, again, you know, I can't emphasize enough that I found the counter narrative that she presents, for instance, about Sati or about bride burning or about the NGOs. I found those really important and necessary. But again, the impulse to have that spring from personal experience and also, to be honest, to write about it as if it, you know, in this sort of monotonous fashion, to not,
mm-hmm.
it de-enlivens history itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that's actually a fascinating kind of history, but I just remember thinking, I mean, this is really important, but man, am I bored.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I had that experience.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was a monotonous read.
Yes.
For me. Yeah.
It really was. I'm like, oh my God, this is boring. How many more pages do I have left?
Right, right.
And then the opposite with Schuller, which is, oh, please, enough already with this
right.
retelling of Cortez's dad dying and calling to her.
Right.
What is this, CSI? What is this, TV narrative?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
no.
And I run into this problem all the time as someone who writes about historical events around, for instance, gay marriage. You know, this need that people have to only devour either deeply interesting personal stories or an analysis. And I do think there are good ways to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I
mm-hmm.
have done them. but that's not what...
What's an example of your writing that I can, you know, I'd like to point people to something
sure.
that you feel like you've written that really, that does that well?
I've written about AOC's crying in a piece about trauma. I can send you that link. But I go through the long histories of trauma narratives in popular culture. Mm-hmm. And the other, so that I think is an interesting piece that people might want to look at. But the other piece I also wrote is about Pete Buttigieg.
Uh-huh, right.
And mm-hmm. his positioning of himself as, you know, the new gay American. And the point I make there is simply that it is a new gay America, and that's the problem. It's a new gay imperial America that actually thinks that killing for the sake of the expansion of a new empire is okay. Mm-hmm. And that, again, is a complicated long piece where I actually look at the history of Afghanistan. I look at the history of Pete Buttigieg. I look at the history of groups like Human Rights Campaign, the Gay Rights Organization. And I look into, so for me, what is interesting about history is to take one moment, right? Like Buttigieg coming into play as a presidential candidate, mm-hmm. but to then consider how that's not just a personal story, but actually a series of events had to have happened before he even was born.
Right.
So even before he came onto the scene, HRC and these gay rights groups were forming themselves into a pro-military, pro-American empire movement, which mm-hmm. was different from the older gay movement, right? So I guess my point is that, and the same is true of Alexandria Cortez, you know, Ocasio-Cortez crying.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I think
there are
like
histories.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought a lot when I was reading the Schuller book, you know, with regard to figures like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, for example, is how is this person a product of not just their immediate time, but
right.
a product of the historical moments that led up to this time and that produced this time.
I think for both of us, right, it's important to be critical of feminism and particularly of white feminism, but we remain hopeful these are just the first salvos, perhaps. But again, there's been a history of critique of white feminism, and it needs to continue. But it needs to continue perhaps in more complicated ways. And I would say that, you know, the publishing world has a lot to answer for in the ways that it makes women writers perhaps conform to certain narrative mm-hmm. requirements. And mm-hmm. That's perhaps a question we can take up in another conversation, which is how are women made to write?
Right.
I don't want to ascribe agency or lack thereof to either of these two writers. But I did see, as someone who's had some amount of experience with publishers and so on, I did see the machinations of a publishing world very much in both these books.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So that's something we could perhaps one day talk about as well. But most of all, thank you so much for this conversation.
Ear to the Pavement is produced by me, Allison Lierish-Dean, in association with Progressive City. Progressive City Radical Alternatives is an online publication dedicated to ideas and practices that advance racial, economic, and social justice. We feature stories on inclusive urban planning practices, grassroots organizing, and civic action. Visit Progressive City at progressivecity.net, where you'll find archived episodes of Ear to the Pavement, as well as articles. Follow me on Twitter at Ear to the Pavement. That's EAR followed by the number 2, and then the pavement. Follow Progressive City on Twitter and Facebook at PCityRadical.